You are listening to the weekly Cybersecurity Podcast, Episode 21, summarizing security news and items of interest for the week ending 21st of October 2016. So let's get started. I'm Stuart from Velocity in Hong Kong, and I'm your host for this episode, and I'm joined by Brendan from the ABSH Group in Melbourne, Australia. Hey there, Brendan.
G'day, Stuart.
If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. Our aim is to produce this every week. Come back often and feel free to add this to your favorite podcast app. So, Brendan, sort of not a lot of news on some fronts, but some big stories on others.
Absolutely. It's been an interesting week, but for me, also an interesting week because we had Melbourne Cup here.
Oh, yes. That's always lots of fun, isn't it?
It is, especially when you win $60.
Lucky you. All right. So our first story for today is back onto shadow brokers. So we've actually discussed the shadow brokers release of classified NSA information on episode 12 on the 19th of August. And that was around the group, as I said, shadow brokers that stole a bunch of NSA zero-day vulnerabilities and released it publicly and then tried to put some stuff up for auction. Well, they've come back again, and they've put a $6 million price tag on the new hoard, or I guess I should say the rest of the NSA hacks that they've been keeping and haven't released yet. Vulnerabilities around the first bunch of releases were confirmed for Cisco, Juniper, Fortinet, and there was a race from the various vendors to actually close these at the time. And in fact, some of them are still only protected via intrusion protection signatures. They still haven't been patched, I believe Cisco in particular on that front. So the shadow brokers had put up an auction for the rest for Bitcoin, and obviously didn't get the amount of money that they were looking for. So they've now basically come out and said that for $6 million, they'll release the rest of them, which is around about 8.4 million Australian dollars or 49 million Hong Kong dollars. So what do you think about that, Brendan?
It's certainly interesting. I think first, it is an interesting move if it is a state-based actor. Typically, you know, if you've been able to compromise another nation state's vulnerabilities and kind of exploit kit, you typically want to keep that to yourself and either use them to hack back or use them to monitor the activities of the other nation state. So that's my first commentary around it. I think the auction was never going to work, mostly because if you read the actual details of the auction, bidders that bid actually lost their money. So it was a really interesting auction. You could put the money up. If you didn't win, they took your money anyway, whatever you'd bid. So I don't think it got past kind of two or three Bitcoin, to be honest. And then obviously we've got the wider commentary around it, you know, relating to. So obviously NSA have had some tools and they use those tools in order to be able to gain access to, you know, various systems, whether that's used for their spying or, you know, internally for make sure that, you know, they can keep tabs on potential terrorist targets or, you know, whatever they're using them for. Those tools are nonetheless still zero-day vulnerabilities, and the wider security community typically takes the stance that, you know, if you come up with a zero-day vulnerability or you discover one, the first thing you should do is report it to the vendor that is the manufacturer of the product. Give them time to obviously try and correct it, release a patch, and then release it to the wider public to let them know to go and update their systems. And obviously, the NSA having access to them is one thing. You know, as long as they keep that under wraps, the potential damage can only be done by the NSA. And you hope, being a government state, it's protected and, you know, requires the various court orders and so forth in order to execute. But when they are leaked, I guess, onto the public internet, you then start putting enterprises and government institutions at risk, as well as the wider public, obviously. But in this case, I mean, you know, the most popular examples were there was exploits for Cisco, there was exploits for Juniper. And when they when they were compromised and those exploits published online, hackers obviously took a week or so to actually go through all of the various data and work out which ones worked and how they worked and so forth. Now, I guess there's an argument there that the NSA could have quietly had a chat with Cisco, Juniper and the various other guys that were targeted and say, hey, well, we have got these vulnerabilities. Here's the analysis on them. This is how they work. Can you guys start putting together some patches? Because you might find by the time the hackers and the dark web kind of worked out how to use them, they've already released patches for them. But by not doing that, they've potentially put the wider community at risk. And like you say, these are enterprise products. They're used by government departments. They're used by medical. They're used by telecommunication providers, enterprises. So it's
I mean, your comment leads directly into sort of the next article, which I found interesting on this, which was a blog entry from a Lawfare blog, which basically had a fairly scathing commentary around sort of the NSA and this whole thing here. I may read a couple of I'll just read a couple of quotes that I've extracted out of this. The first one is, there is a defensible argument for not informing offender about a zero day where the agency is confident nobody else knows about it. But if the NSA has reason to suspect an adversary has captured a zero day, the use of which could substantially impact US interests, it is critical that the NSA report it to the vendors in the interest of defense. So this directly addresses one of the things, some of the things that you were just describing there. Now, the NSA claimed that it had tuned its sensors, and it has probably the largest, I guess you'd call it a sensor network in the world, any known intelligence agency. But the article went on to say that two exploits in particular challenged that we'd know if it were used premise, in particular Extra Bacon, targeting Cisco equipment, and the Agrarious Blunder, I love the names by the way, exploit targeting FortiGate. Both of the vulnerabilities directly impact systems used in the United States, including the national security systems NSA is tasked with defending, and more critically, would not be able to be detected in the wild by NSA sensors. And the reason they say this is because these particular types of exploits are generally used to pivot. Now, what that means is that once an attacker has actually got a foothold inside someone's network, okay, let's say they've managed to get a phishing email into one user inside a network, they can then use these particular exploits inside the network to access the internal network, because sometimes that's the only way to access things like the SNMP and the web interfaces, the administration interfaces, and then they own those firewalls, and then from that point onwards they have pretty much unlimited access to anything in the network. So it's from my perspective, I totally agree with you there, Brendan, that it sounds to me like the NSA has really done a disservice to, both US and obviously allied interests on this, because what they have essentially done is put their own country and their own industries at risk.
Yeah, it's certainly disappointing. I think there was another argument there too that suggesting potentially the NSA didn't know that they had been breached and therefore wouldn't know to report it. But
when shadow brokers put this stuff out,
yeah,
they then at that point could have gone and said,
yeah,
yes. You might want to patch these holes, and this is what we've.
this is the kind of things they're going to find when they start digging through the. For zero-day vulnerabilities.
Yeah, that are going to be released publicly.
Yeah, And that stuff was from 2012. So you are talking about vulnerabilities that are potentially being patched, so you really don't know what you're getting.
Yep, very much so.
Talking about patches.
Moving on, yes, our next story is Oracle. Oracle has released its critical patch update for October 2016. And I would have to say that while this is not a record, this is a pretty major patch update. So 253 vulnerabilities from across multiple products, including Oracle Communications Applications, 36 patches, MySQL, 31 patches, Fusion Middleware, 29 patches, Financial Services Applications, 24, Oracle eBusiness Suite, 21, Java SE, Oracle Database, Oracle PeopleSoft, and Retail Applications. Half of these vulnerabilities allow a remote attacker to take control of an affected system. And it's the second largest update that Oracle has released to date, but is smaller than July's 276 patches. It includes remote code execution vulnerabilities in their core database, as well as MySQL, Oracle Secure Backup, and Java. And of course, from our perspective, the most worrying is Java, which continues to be one of the principal sources of attack vectors going into companies, because Java is unfortunately still commonly installed on many browser systems. There are seven new security fixes for Java SE affecting both Java 6, 7, and 8, and all are remotely exploitable without any authentication. Yay. They have a common vulnerability scoring standard, which is from the CVE, score of 9.6, and that is out of 10, so that's about as high as you can get on the scale without being a 10. And, of course, according to Oracle, vulnerabilities apply to Java deployments in clients running Sandbox Java WebStar applications or Sandbox Java applets that load and run untrusted code. So, if you have Java, please update. We're looking for version 8, update 111, and if you have anything older than that, please get rid of it. So what do you think about that one, Brendan?
Look, it's...
a big sigh there.
It's just, you know, Java, Flash, you know, all of these older technologies and older tools that we're using, you know, they provide a simplicity and they make coding easy cross-platform, but, you know, they just consistently are vulnerable targets. You know, when you're talking about a threat landscape, if you could eliminate Java and Flash, you'd probably reduce your threat landscape by 90%. Sorry, threat landscape, your attack surface. And, you know, 9.6 score, I mean, that's a... Mostly, I think that's because of the remote code execution. So you can remote...
doesn't require anything, yeah.
Yeah, I mean... good to see that obviously Java and Chrome and those kind of browsers have automatic updates now. So most people do get those fixes without actually being aware that they're getting them. It's unfortunate on one point, I guess, because people do kind of just expect things to work these days. They expect them to work. They expect them to be secure. And unfortunately, that's really not the case. I mean, you talk to any small business, home user, I've even seen companies 50, 100 users and there's no patching strategy for apps. You know, they patch Windows, but they don't patch Adobe. They don't patch Flash. They don't patch Java. They just don't see it as a really important priority, nor as a major attack vector. So they just don't bother. But I guess they learn the lesson once they get owned, and then they start to patch Java and or remove it. The other thing I see a lot of is Java installed on servers. And I'm not talking about terminal servers. I'm just talking, you know, domain controllers, SQL boxes.
The issue is that historically, you know, the promise of Java was write an application once, it runs anywhere. So particularly server vendors, when I say server vendors, server application vendors, unfortunately, have often done their applications in Java, because then you can have it run on a Linux box or a Windows box or a, you know, some other thing. And yes, you do unfortunately sometimes see these things on servers because the application vendors have decided that that was the easiest route to take to make something cross-platform.
Yeah, it comes back to simplicity over security, I guess.
Indeed, it does. You know, and you see that even these days on the mobile platforms. You know, vendors tend to focus on, say, the two biggest ones, iOS and Android, and don't do application development for the smaller guys, and so they don't get the applications, which becomes a sort of a catch-22 because they don't have the applications, people don't buy them, and the circle continues to spiral down until they disappear. And sort of, you know, BlackBerry and Windows on mobile has been classic examples of that.
So I guess in summary, we're still seeing consistently that your first line of defense is patching, and you just can't have it as a human thing. You know, I've seen a couple of clients where they literally have a person whose job it is to go around to the machines and install all the updates. But that just doesn't cut it anymore. You know, you need to have a patching policy, you need to have it automated, you need to be using a system, and you need to do it regularly. And that's hard as well, right? Because, you know, not all patches, unfortunately, are good for you
sometimes. Smoothly go in, they break things.
If you have got Java, please update it. And if you're using any of the Oracle Enterprise applications, obviously have a chat with them, deploy it out to your test and dev and staging servers, and then if no adverse reactions, get them rolled out to production.
And make sure, obviously, as much as possible that they're not not exposed, because most of them do have remotely exploitable systems.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so moving on. And the other, we're moving on to breaches now. And I guess the, well, it doesn't really count as a breach. Had a big story or sort of breaking news, if you want to call it.
I was going to say, it's almost like a live. We're doing this live now.
Dyn appears to be taken down by a massive DDoS, which is a distributed denial of service attack, which is bringing down everything from Twitter, PayPal, Spotify, Netflix, Amazon, Reddit, and a host of other big, big, big sites. It's this is very much someone is targeting the core infrastructure of the internet, and we will see where this goes. You want to provide some more details on this one, Brendan?
Yeah, look, I've added it into the show notes just now because I was having some issues getting to Twitter. I was just trying to update some of my Twitter and it wasn't loading. We don't have a huge amount of detail right at this time. Obviously, we do know that there is a massive distributed denial of service attack, and for those that aren't aware what that is, it's basically a Dyn are a DNS, and DNS forms the backbone. It basically converts website addresses into IP addresses. So computers obviously run on numbers, and when you want to go to a website, the computer actually needs to know the IP address of that website. And DNS bridges that gap so that you can type in www.twitter.com and it says, yep, twitter.com is 192.168.whatever.whatever. And then redirects your browser over there. Now, if you take down that that service, obviously you can't convert web pages into IP addresses, and therefore you can't connect. Now, certainly someone is targeting Dyn. Dyn's a very popular DNS service provider. They also provide a number of distributed denial of service attack prevention products. So it's interesting that they're being successful. I'm just going to guess now. I'm going to put some I guess try and read the future. It wouldn't surprise me if this is the same botnet or group that recently targeted their Krebs on Security website, which hit about 650 megabits per second, or the Sorry, that was 650 gigabits per second, not meg. Or the same bot, sorry, and that was the same bot that hit the French ISP OVH a couple of weeks back. And that one, I think, was around the 1 terabit per second mark. So
yeah, it's like 990 or something like that, I think, was the official statement. Yeah.
So I guess watch this space.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we'll have a more detailed analysis on this one next week, but it certainly seems to be an interesting attack, because the attack is having an impact on some major service providers, which is certainly interesting. It's possibly more targeted. It may certainly be targeted on specific geographical locations, because Dyn themselves are obviously global.
Yeah. So, I think I just on that, Stuart, I think it is, because we use Dyn ourselves, and I can tell you that Australian Dyn is resolving fine. Like, I don't have any issues, but it does seem to be US based. And obviously the services that have all gone down are all US organizations. Power, Spotify, Twitter, etc. It's interesting. Whoever has access to this botnet, if it is the same botnet that took down Krebs on Security and that French ISP, I'm not sure this is the smartest move, only because, I mean, you're targeting the internet, right? You're trying to basically take down a staple. It's like, you know, the basic human rights. So now you're going to attract attention from NSA, from FBI, from government. You know, they're going to throw full resources at trying to bring this people to justice. And on top of that, you're talking about taking on some of the world's largest companies. I mean, Amazon, Netflix, PayPal. When they guys start putting their heads together and start throwing resources at this, it'd be very interesting to see the outcome and how quickly, or if ever, they are able to identify the perpetrator and bring them to justice. But
so what you're saying is that the FBI and the NSA really don't care too much when they're targeting a French ISP?
Yeah. What I'm saying is the US are very, very patriotic, and they don't like it when people start destroying their basic services, which they've come to expect.
I will completely agree with you on that. And while we're on that, I'm going to move to the next story, which is actually US-based again. So the next story is hackers hitting the US Senate GOP committee, GOP, the Republican Senatorial Committee, website was compromised by hackers. It was one of 5,900 e-commerce sites apparently hacked by the same actors, including Converse and Audi, of all things. It was a malware that was skimming credit card details from merchandise transactions and devices. Basically, what happens is that they inject an extra piece of JavaScript into the website that's obfuscated, which means it's sort of hidden, which then pulls some additional code from another server that then whenever there is a checkout style, so like when you're going to a e-commerce site and you do the checkout page, it then skims the credit card information and passes it off to this one. It's quite interesting in the fact that it was actually fairly simple injection. I was looking at that earlier myself, and in some ways you would think it would be fairly easy to block, but you were saying, Brendan, that you'd done some tests yourself and found that certainly the IDP IDS system you're using hadn't flagged it, so it's
a couple of them, Stuart. Yeah, I tested it on a few different IDP IDS services, and none of them are still detecting it. So it was an interesting piece of malware. Like, whoever's written it is quite clever. It's not a script kiddie or it's taken some real effort to put together. One of the key things I noticed on it was they're actually storing the malware in the database. I mean, even us, we scan all the websites we host every night. We run through all the HTML, all the PHP, every file that's on there, and just look for, using regular expressions, various bits and pieces that we know are bad. And if you did that, these sites, they'd come up clean. Because the actual malware is sitting in the database, and that's a lot harder to scan. But honestly, hand on heart, it was surprising for me to find out that the IDS and IDP systems that we're deploying and utilizing aren't detecting it.
In a lot of ways, it's
yeah, they're not cheap systems, and they're not. I won't name names, but they're, you know, they're quite well known systems and brands. So
I think it just goes back, and this is, you know, part of the reason why we started this podcast in the first place. The security landscape is just changing so rapidly. There's so much stuff going on. Even the big guys are having trouble keeping up with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to remedy it, we actually wrote our own little detection into the monitoring system that we use to actually monitor uptime and response times and load times of websites. And, you know, we're able to put some regular expression scanning in there for our clients. But, I guess it's testament that, like you're just saying, you know, the technology landscape, or the threat landscape rather, is changing. It's no longer a set and forget. I remember the good old days of writing HTML websites, and you could load them up with a counter and a couple of, you know, little GIF files and some audio, and yeah, you could leave it there for years, and very rarely did it ever get attacked. But these days, you know, if you're going to run a website, it's quite a significant investment. You need to decide on a CMS. You need to decide on a bulletproof hosting provider that's, you know, serious about security. You then need to have a strategy on how you're going to patch that system that's running your website. You know, even if it's a WordPress or a Joomla or a Drupal or one of these, even Magento. You know, every one of these, there's constant vulnerabilities that are found, and I think that's going to grow. I think, you know, that the security industry is growing. You know, we're getting more and more security researchers every day as people, you know, come through uni. And for a lot of people, it's quite an interesting area of study. So the security community is getting larger, which means we've got more people analyzing code and more people finding bugs. And some of these vendors are doing the right thing. You know, they've got bug bounty programs, and it's working. I think I was reading an article the other day about I can't remember the vendor, but they were saying that, you know, their bug bounty programs found 500 bugs. Yeah, that's 500 more bugs that they would not have found on their own. So you need to keep your website updated and patch it just as much as you need to keep your Adobe, your Flash, your Java, your Windows updated.
There's been examples, I think, even earlier this year where, you know, there was a vulnerability found for one of the major CMSs. I believe it was WordPress. And if you hadn't patched it within 4 hours, you were compromised.
Compromised, yeah.
So, if, you know, if this had occurred in the middle of your night, chuffed. By the time you woke up, your website was owned.
Yeah, and that's where you're really reliant on
A third party managing patching those systems.
Yeah, you really need your IDP and IDS. So for those that are listening that don't know what those are, that's your intrusion prevention or intrusion detection systems. So it's very, very much important, and obviously, you know, everything we've been talking about, make sure you've got strong passwords, because often they compromise your websites using, if you've got the default credentials, admin password, 123456, so enable your two-factor authentication. And when you're patching, you know, you've got to remember to patch your add-ons as well. I've seen so many times when there's a vulnerability in an add-on, like an uploader or something, and my WordPress is up to date, but I hadn't updated that add-on.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, again, some good recommendations here, obviously, around that. In continuation, even look at things like scanning your website, you know, particularly the websites are often hosted on servers using files, and the number of times that I've seen, you know, virus products, for example, where the virus is sitting on a website, sometimes days, months, after it should have been detected, you know, so actually run a virus scanner on the server itself. So even if it's, you know, even if it's a demand scan only, then you can run it once a day and make sure that there's nothing been added to the server and the files on the server.
Yeah, totally agree with you.
The other thing, of course, is to seriously consider looking at GeoIP blocking. Obviously, it's not a perfect solution. What that refers to is making sure that you, so for example, if you're only doing business in Australia, you can actually get a list of IP addresses that apply to all of the ISPs in Australia, so you can literally block anyone from outside of Australia getting access to your, say, your e-commerce solution or whatever else. Of course, those things aren't perfect because people do use VPNs and do get sometimes IP blocks that get transferred from one location to another one. But certainly that can be a good step to also lock down security on an e-commerce system on a website.
And just on the GeoIP blocking, be careful if you're hosting your websites in cloud providers like AWS or Azure. I know for a fact that, for example, Microsoft ran out of IPv4 space in America.
Yeah.
So they actually bought an IPv block from, I think it was Brazil.
South America. Yeah, it was the South American one, Brazil or something like
that. Yeah. So if you obviously GeoIP block, you're going to get machines coming from Brazil that are actually in the US, but the systems yeah. think they're from South America. So,
yeah. Well, we have the same system here when our ISP has multiple data centers around Asia, and one of the blocks that we got given for IPs was actually for Japan, despite the fact that we're actually using those in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
So if you went and had a look at an IP lookup on it, it said we're in I think it was Kyoto, Japan, supposedly where that server was located, which of course was not true.
Yeah, so just be careful if you're going to implement GeoIP blocking. It's certainly a strategy and it's still an effective one, but just consider the impact and make sure you test it, do it off hours. Obviously, if your website's least busy on a Monday morning, that would be the time to switch it on and start training it.
Yep. Yep. All right. And
news bites for the week.
News bites for the week. I will let you take the banking malware one there for Australian users there.
The banking malware that's affecting the Australian banks and mostly the top four. So this is a really interesting article. I had a lot of enjoyment reading it, not because of the target or anything like that, but so in 2014, there was a banking Trojan called Dyer. It was one of the most prolific banking Trojans the world has ever seen. It infected hundreds of thousands of machines. It stole millions of dollars from businesses using wire fraud. You might have seen it in the news. The big story was Ryanair, the budget aircraft carrier in the US. They were fleeced out of $5.5 million. And other businesses, there were stories in the paper saying that, they'd lost $1.5 million here, $1.3 million there. So it was really prolific. And it actually ended in February of 2016. The authors of that banking Trojan were actually captured. They were arrested and that certainly saw the end of the Dyer Trojan. But recently, a new piece of malware has been released. It's been spotted in the wild. It's called TrickBot. It's specifically targeting Australian banks, and it looks to be an improved version of the old Dyer Trojan. So potentially someone very close to the developers or authors is now working with the new group, or potentially they didn't capture everybody. It's only a recently detected Trojan. It basically enters your network using a standard phishing spam campaign. So, you get one email that says, your invoice is overdue, or a Word document with staff bonuses or something like that, asking you to enable a macro. It then uses that information to steal your banking credentials. It then accesses your bank and tries to conduct some wire fraud. So at this stage, it has been seen in the wild. It's certainly not reached the proliferation of Dyer, but there is certainly a lot of concern within the security community just because the code is so close to Dyer. Like, they're not saying that this is a new Trojan. They're saying basically someone has rewritten the Dyer Trojan and made it better. and they're testing it here. So watch this space. I'm sure there'd be some more to come. And I don't know, can you think of any recommendations, Stuart, on how users might protect themselves?
Well, I mean, one of the comments I'll add on this first is that certainly I've read a number of times over the last few years that Australia and the UK are often used as testing grounds before they start a major campaign in North America.
Yeah.
Because it's, again, an English-speaking country, they can use the same types of, phishing emails and other things, very similar in terms of what kind of infrastructure is used, operating systems, all those kinds of things. So that can be why you see these things first in Australia before you get a major campaign in the United States. In terms of you protecting yourself, very much a case of, you have to use things like second factor authentication. I would really be looking at having a secure browser for banking access, if at all possible. If you're a company, access to the banking website maybe should be restricted to one or two machines rather than allowing it from anywhere, which may make it harder for someone to get an infection in the network there. Other than that, it's really just the same best practices that we're always recommending. Make sure your passwords are complex, that you're not reusing a password with another site. If someone does actually manage to get a Trojan on your machine that you're doing banking from, then it's probably game over.
Mm. Yeah, and the only other things I guess we could add there would be, be hyper vigilant when you're using email, especially if you're in that position of an organization where you do deal with finance and you have access to money. Double check every email that you're looking at. If you're not expecting it, send it off to IT first. Just ask them. It takes 5 minutes for you to do that. Invoices typically don't need to be paid the same day. You usually get 14, 15, 30 days to pay them. So be hypervigilant. Try to avoid getting affected in the first place. For small businesses, I'm going to say one thing that I have seen that can be effective is having multiple authorizations required, which means, yes, they might infect your machine and grab your credentials and be able to log into your banking. But if you then have another person that's got to go in and authorize a transaction before it's allowed, that can sometimes be a nice backup plan also, especially when you couple it with something like two-factor authentication. It's not foolproof, but certainly it, and again...
I mean, the banking system that we use here, and this is something I can't really comment on for Australian banks, but the main bank that we're using here in Hong Kong, which is HSBC for both personal and our business, the two-factor system actually requires you to also verify the account and the quantity of the amount of money that's being sent, even with an online transaction. So when you, for example, want to authorize an online transaction, it then takes one of the values and you run it through a hash on the actual second factor device and re-put it in to make sure that it hasn't been a man in the middle that's modified the account number that you're sending it to. So that they've certainly addressed some of those things here, but I can't address on whether Australian banks have done that.
Yeah, I certainly... I know the banks that we use certainly don't do that. In fact, some of them are still sending their second factor via SMS. So yeah. I would say we're potentially a little far behind in the security landscape.
Yeah.
Any other news bites for the week, Stuart?
I think the last one for today, and then we'll wrap it up, was just more of an interest one, which was, one of the concerns that we've had with the advent of quantum computing being around the corner was that there were fears that encryption as we know it would literally be dead. One of the promises of quantum computing is to basically instantaneously be able to solve certain types of calculations, which would currently take potentially years or even decades to actually do a solve for, and particularly that was around encryption. And so some boffins, as they put it in this article, have said that our state-of-the-art hashing, it's actually hashing algorithm now, which is SHA-3 in particular, but even SHA-256 quantum proof, at least in how we're currently using quantum algorithms for solving quantum computing problems. So basically they've come out with and said that the outcome for both SHA-256 and SHA-3-256, they need around 2,166 quantum qubit cycles to crack, or about 10 to the 32 years, which is actually longer than the universe has supposedly been in existence. So we don't have to worry about that right now.
So what you're telling me is if we had have invented a computer when the Earth was started, we still wouldn't have cracked the password.
I will take it a step further. If we had invented the computer when the star that went supernova that went in to create another star that went supernova that made the material that made our planet, we still wouldn't have cracked it. So we're talking a few years here.
That is certainly very good to know.
I'm sure we'll have more to come on that in the years to come as people get their heads around quantum computing and different algorithms. But certainly as quantum computing as we know it now, we are safe from our hashing systems being
definitely
compromised.
Think watch this space, because China I think just took the lead in quantum computing. I think they just finished building the fastest, largest, quickest quantum computer in the world just recently.
China's going to be interesting to watch, and of course I live in China, although it's a sort of a separate entity in being Hong Kong, but China's certainly going to be interesting to watch because they're taking the lead in quite a few interesting industries at the moment. So.
I think, and I'll correct this but I next week, but I think it was Hitachi.
Hitachi's Japanese.
Right. Okay. But I'm pretty sure it was Hitachi that China used in order to build the quantum computer.
Could be. I mean, Hitachi's been building supercomputers for quite a number of years. Mm. And China does actually have some of the fastest supercomputers on the planet now. In fact, I think they have more than the United States in the top 10.
Yeah. And I know that there's always the race. Obviously, quantum computers, for those that are listening, aren't cheap. So it's like an arms race. I build one this year and then I've got to redo it in 3 years. So next year, the next country goes and builds their one because their 3 year is up and they've got to refresh it. And then therefore they have the fastest now. And it's typically been IBM and I think Hitachi, going pretty much neck and neck. But this was, China's new super quantum computer
It's very much a game of leapfrog. These are systems which, as computers have for the last 40, 50 years, there are leaps and bounds occurring every year, and we're doubling computing power every 18 months. In fact, I think it's even been speeding up over the years, so that there has been certainly anything that you build now will definitely be out of date. Relatively speaking, fairly quickly. Now, while it might still be useful, it certainly won't be the latest and greatest. Absolutely. And I think, on that note, we should wrap up today's podcast.
Totally agree.
All right, so that covers off our major security-related events for this week. Thanks for listening, and if you have any topics you would like us to cover, please feel free to contact Brendan or myself. Until next week, stay safe, and what's your closing word, Brendan?
Don't reuse your passwords.